The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Katha Pollitt's review of Elaine Showalter's latest book begins with a nod to an earlier work. Pollitt writes, Showalter's A Literature of Their Own, British women novelists from Bronte to Lessing, changed the way we read fiction by women by showing female writers in historical, political, and literary relation to one another and doing it in prose that was energetic, enjoyable, and blessedly free of academic jargon. 30 years and many books later, Showalter has done for America what she did for Britain. And the results are equally exhilarating, provocative, revelatory, and even more magisterial. A professor emeritus at Princeton University who has also written about television for People magazine and her love of fashion for Vogue, Elaine Showalter is a witty, discerning aficionado of culture, both high and low. She has been described in the Dictionary of Literary Biography as one of the founders of feminist criticism and still one of its most important and influential practitioners. Her latest book, Katha Pollitt writes, takes its title from Susan Glassbell's 1917 story, A Jury of Her Peers, in which a sheriff and an attorney, at a loss to find a reason why a wife would murder her husband, overlook clues to his brutality and her desperation that their wives, rummaging around the farmhouse crime site, easily discover and, sympathizing with the accused, destroy. Women, of course, could not sit on juries in 1917 or even vote. They were judged and governed by laws and codes and procedures they had no hand in making or applying. In the same way, Showalter argues, for most of our history, women writers lacked a critical jury of their peers to discuss their work, to explicate its symbols and meanings, and to demonstrate its continuing relevance to all readers. Joining us tonight with her overview of women writers in America to discuss which voices matter and who gets to decide, and, if we're lucky, to tell us why chick lit isn't the problem, but Gertrude Stein might be. Gentlemen and ladies, please welcome Elaine Showalter.
Thanks so much. I mean, what a thrill to be introduced by Jennifer Weiner. I had no idea until I got here that that was going to be the case. I was just at Princeton talking to the English department there and staying in the Nassau Inn, which is one of the famous old lodging places in Princeton, and they have just put up their second picture of a woman alum in the Yankee Doodle tap room of the Nassau Inn. And the first picture was Brooke Shields. The second one is Michelle Obama. And I'm waiting for Jennifer to get up there, too. And Jodi Picoult and a whole bunch of astonishing women writers who have come out of Princeton in the last decades. I'll just start out by saying something about chick lit, which I admire and find endlessly fascinating. And in my book, I talk about it in the chapter on the 1990s. My book is organized pretty much by decades after the beginning where I group some together in the very start of our country. But then I go decade by decade. And all the way through, as well as looking at poetry and drama and experimental fiction and every kind of genre of writing in which women were involved, I'm looking at popular fiction. And from the very beginning, popular fiction made American men furious when it was by women. I mean, you start with Hawthorne in the 1850s, where is this sudden outburst for the first time of enormous bestsellers by women. And of course, Uncle Tom's Cabin is the most famous, but there were dozens of novels by women that just sold phenomenally. And Hawthorne called them that damned mob of scribbling women. Ever since, and it's really beginning formally in 1857 when the Atlantic Monthly started to publish, what's been special about American literature is this almost policed division between elite and popular fiction, as if they were not often the same. As if Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was read in Europe by Tolstoy, by Turgenev, by Balzac, by George Eliot and George Sand, as if it were not a great novel as well as a great commentary on race and politics. So this split has really continued, I think, up to the present, and it's one of the reasons that women have had trouble getting on literary juries. It's somehow always assumed that women writers, if they are widely read, if people line up to hear them, there must be something the matter with what they're producing. But all the way through the book, I talk about these bestsellers, and I talk about Gone with the Wind. I talk about a novel that meant a great deal to me when I was a little girl, reading it secretly when my mother was out of the house, Forever Amber. I don't know if any of you read this. And so, of course, when I came to the 1990s, one of the things that I was looking at was what are the, not just the individual novels and the individual writers, but what are the categories of literary invention that will mark this decade in the future that people will look back on and see this happening? And it's really fascinating to me that in a decade where, on the one hand, women became free to write about anything that they wanted to, one of the things that they chose to write about was the situation of women, young women in their 20s and 30s. But I also think that what's fascinating about those novels and about very successful fiction in general is that it leads you back to the culture and it leads you back to the historical moment. And certainly for me, doing the research for this book, that was the case. Just to give one example, when I was writing about the 1930s, which was also a decade of bestsellers. It's the decade of Gone with the Wind and many other novels that were highly successful. Researching them, I was shocked, really astonished to discover how many heroines of novels in the 30s had abortions, and also how many of the women writing those novels had abortions. I had no idea that abortion was so widespread in the 1930s, and that led me back to doing research about abortion in the United States during the Depression and discovering, fascinating, that the 1930s had the highest abortion rate of any decade in the 20th century, and that most of the women seeking abortions were married rather than single. And of course, if you reflect on it a little bit, you can understand why this is so. But if I had set out to write important themes in literature, important themes in culture, and made a list and then go to find novels about them, it never would have occurred to me to look at abortion in the 1930s. And it was one of those instances that was so revealing. Just as I think, you know, what's categorized or sort of bailed together as chick lit in the 1990s is so relevant to the social problems and political events of that decade, just as Good in Bed, Jennifer's first, you know, great first novel, is so much reflects the Monica Lewinsky era and a period of sort of media contempt for women's bodies, and the way in which women were made to hate themselves, and that hatred focusing around a national hatred for Monica Lewinsky. So these books are not only, I think, engaging and revealing and extremely intelligent and written by authors like Jennifer, who are incredibly well-educated and well-read, but they're also, they really tell you so much about our country and our national tradition that you couldn't find out any other way. Now, to just sort of talk a little bit about how I came to write this book, as Jennifer said, my first book, which came out of my dissertation, was about English women novelists. It's called A Literature of Their Own, and it was published in 1977. And I always thought, after that book came out, that someday I would write a literature of our own. Because the title of that book, A Literature of Their Own, was, it's actually a quotation from John Stuart Mill about women, but it was also, for me, a way of indicating that this was about British women, was not about American women, and the literature was theirs and not mine, and I always felt a little kind of anxiety about trying to put myself at the center of somebody else's culture. And I always wanted to do the same for Americans. And I'm a Bostonian by birth. I grew up in the absolute heartland of American literature and culture. And I thought, well, someday I'm going to do this. And years went by while I was teaching at Princeton and working very hard and doing a number of other things. And still there was no one was writing a literary history of American women writers. And finally, in 2003, I said to myself, well, it's now or never. Either I'm going to do this now or somebody is going to beat me to it. They have to beat me to it. And so I took early retirement from Princeton to write this book. And I was just astonished that by 2003, nobody had ever tried to write a literary history of American women writers. There is not even a bad one. There is not even, you know, a nasty one. No one had ever undertaken it. And, of course, when I sat down to do it, I thought, well, what is the curse of this book? Why are people staying away from it? Well, the obvious reason, of course, is that it's a huge job. I mean, this is an enormous country. It's not like England. I did a lot of traveling around to British libraries, but you can get around the whole of Great Britain in about a week without too much trouble. And it's not like the United States, where libraries are so far flung that I thought, am I going to have the stamina to finish this book? Will I have the longevity to finish this book? Will I have the chutzpah to finish this book? And when I started to do it, when I actually committed myself to the research, I discovered, to my joy, that miraculously it has become, in the 21st century, much easier to do this kind of literary research than when I had started out. And the reasons: digitalization, the availability of so many texts online from so many libraries that have been digitalized, collections that are available. I was able to read at my desk hundreds of novels that, you know, 15 years ago I would have had to travel endlessly to see. And through Amazon and Abe Books, which list rare books available all over the country, I was able to put together my own library fairly efficiently. That was really amazing. And for somebody of my generation, still seems almost like a miracle that, you know, you can click this machine on your desk and be reading a novel from the 1800s that has not been in print since it first came out. But then the bad news was that if the 21st century is the best time to be doing the research, it's the worst time to be doing the writing. And this was the other reason why nobody else had done it. Because during the intervening decades between the time I wrote my book about English women writers and now, there was a whole ideological shift within academia about writing literary history. And people felt that not only that writing literary history was very difficult, but that in fact it was so difficult you shouldn't even try to do it. There was something totally wrong about it. And on the academic side, a couple of the issues about this. Some academics felt there is just no way that you can combine history and literature. You can't do justice to a historical narrative and literary criticism and a text. This is impossible. But the people who were saying it's impossible also said, but somebody's got to do it. We have to have literary history. We must have it. Otherwise, you just have these vast encyclopedias floating off into space with a lot of names and a lot of writers, but we don't know how to put them together. We don't know how they connect. We don't know how they relate to each other. So we need literary history. This man who teaches at Harvard said, he said, but I'm not going to write it. Somebody else must write it. Now, feminists were also very suspicious of literary history because they said literary history is totally male. And what it's about is creating some sort of hierarchy of the best writers by, according to some traditional standard, which is clearly going to be very patriarchal and is not going to be fair to women. And we must not do this. And even though since the 1970s, feminist scholars have been participating in what's sometimes called the recovery movement, which is reclaiming these texts by American women writers, getting them back into print, editing their letters, writing biographies, and so on. Recovery is fine. Literary judgment, no. And a lot of feminist scholars would say it's much too soon. We mustn't try to do this yet. We will lose a lot if we try to rank them. We totally disapprove of this. Some of these feminists even think that chronology is patriarchal. And they arrange their books thematically instead of by dates. You know, and if you're a literary historian, you've just got to have chronology. I mean, that is sort of comes with the territory. But some of them say the mantra for this point of view is chronicity breeds linear thinking. So I realize, well, I've got to be chronological. Call me linear. What am I going to do? Here I am. But I felt always that I was going to be writing in the face of this kind of objection. And people who write American literature, finally, are probably the most disenchanted and have lost the most confidence of all in what it means. What does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to have an American literature? What does it mean to have an American history? It's a tremendous amount of anxiety about this, which has become more and more self-defeating. There are some people who write about American history and literature who will not accept the word American. Because they say American, that's a very imperialist term, and if we call ourselves Americans, it's as if we're saying, oh, all of North America, Central America, South America, we're claiming all these continents. Now, I live in England part of the time for a long while, and it is not my experience is when people say they are anti-American, they are not against Mexico. But within the profession, you know, of American studies, this became very frightening. United States is a problem, too, because we were not always the United States. And there's a lot of literature being produced before we had a United States and before certain territories were within it. So how is that going to go about? These are the kind of academic issues about writing literary history. But there are also, I think, more general issues about it that anybody would ask, certainly that reviewers will ask, that people will wonder, how do you decide who you're going to put in? I knew from the beginning, I started out and I knew and my editors knew that we wanted the book to be one volume. We wanted it to be something that people could pick up and hold on to and read in, if not all the way through, that it wouldn't be so massive. It wouldn't be like an encyclopedia that you'd want to have on your shelves. It would be reader-friendly and accessible in that way. So we knew that it had to have a finite length. And I wanted it to, at the same time, reflect literature that was good as well as worthy. And I felt very strongly about this. It's one of the reasons that I was determined to write this by myself. Now, if you know anything about literary histories, national literary histories, literary history of England, of Spain, or France, or whatever, usually, or the United States, ordinarily, traditionally, they are done by huge committees. Many, many scholars get together. They have, you know, 50 or so collaborators, they have a board of editors of 10 people, they have 200 research assistants, then they have contributors, and these histories take decades to complete. And very often, contributors who have been assigned, you will write the literary history of the novel from 1857 to 1859, and people will die and they still have not finished 1857 to 1859. But in addition to that, I think, as we all know, committees do not have opinions, okay? And they certainly do not have literary opinions. So when you get that kind of literary history, value judgments tend to flatten out. There is selection, of course, and omission, and those are implicit value judgments. But the actual writing tends to be fairly bland and fairly pedantic. And I wanted to be able to say in the book, who is really exciting to read? Who is really important to read? Who is tragic? Who is comic? Who is overrated? How do they relate to each other? To really have a lot of opinions and be able to say the literary book stops here. So I undertook it by myself. I've already mentioned, with relation to Chick Lit, that I wanted to include popular literature, bestsellers, children's literature, a field in which American women were really pioneers. And it's very funny, Lydia Mariah Child, who was one of the first women to start writing children's literature professionally said, I'm American enough to care for money more than fame. And she really set out to do this. And one of certainly the most famous book by an American woman writer, I think, Little Women, was certainly produced and published and marketed in the beginning as a children's book, although Alcott really holds up to the most sustained reading, I think. So it was going to be inclusive. It was going to be something that people would be would like to read and not something that they felt they had to read, that they should have read, that they ought to know about. Now, literary history, as you can see from this introduction, it is not for the faint-hearted because the research is certainly very time-consuming. It's very pleasant. I mean, I think there are a lot worse things in the world than to be spending your time reading novels and poems and plays by amazing American women writers. But it is hard to make choices, to be able to imagine how you defend those choices and how they connect to each other. And it is something that people get quite agitated about. And one of the questions that people raise, I think, about this kind of book, it's a question that seems a bit old-fashioned to me, but I think maybe it's a perennial, is why do you want to single out women? Why do you want to just focus on women writers? What is meaningful about that? Isn't that just retrograde? Aren't you just sort of putting them back into some kind of separate corner of their own? And as some people have said to me, male writers have trouble getting published. Male writers' careers are often very difficult. Male writers disappear from literary history and are forgotten. And this is true. But I think, and what I want to talk about a little bit more this evening, is that it is really of a different caliber for women. In my hometown now of Washington, D.C., there's a bookstore called Politics and Prose, and one of the women who owns that store, Carla Cohen, said to the New York Times recently, a very funny piece, she said, when people come into my bookstore, she says, it's like a wedding. The men turn to the right, which is politics, sociology, and sports, and the women turn to the left, which is the fiction. We have known for 150 years that women are by far the majority of the readers, the buyers, the judges, the bloggers, the book club members who deal with American fiction. And yet, you see this pattern again and again and again of a woman who is very famous during her lifetime, honored, showered with critical praise, given the highest literary awards our country can bestow, the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, even the Nobel Prize, Pearl Buck, back in the 1930s. And when she dies, it's as if she never existed. She absolutely disappears. Her audience, in a way, vanishes with her. And it began to be quite clear to me that the reason for this is that women read fiction, men write literary history. And I really felt that has to be changed. There has to be an intervention in this category of literary discourse, and I'm going to take it on. And as I joke with my family, I expect that there'll be a lot of arguing and debate, but I'm ready for that, and nobody knows where I live these days since I retired from Princeton. I feel I can say that. Now, I wanted to just tell you about one woman in the book to give you an idea of the kind of thing that I discovered and the cases that made me feel so important to look at women writers and to understand the experiences that they had and the struggles and obstacles they had to overcome. And this is not one of the great geniuses. This is not one of the women whose name is part of the record or whose name is, you know, listed in the table of contents of books, even if you skip over it. This is Julia Ward Howe, who we know for one work, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Julia Ward Howe wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and she is famous for that. What we don't know about Julia Howe is that, first of all, Julia Howe lived to be 90 years old. She was born in 1820, and she lived until 1910. She was tremendously active in civic and political and philanthropic events, and she was a very well-known woman in her day. But by the time she died, everyone had forgotten that before she wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic and in the early years of her marriage, she was a woman who wanted to be a great writer, who wanted to write the great American novel, the great American play, the great American poem, had, you know, vast ambition, and who was stopped cold by her husband. Now, Julia Ward Howe came from New York. She came from a very rich family. She was very well educated privately in the classics, in French and German. By the time she was 16, she had decided that she would have a literary career. By the time she was 20, she was publishing book reviews in journals and magazines of European art and literature. And then, in her early 20s, and she was very pretty and charming, and you also have to think of her as a contemporary of Whitman's. So this is exactly in the period that Whitman was developing as a poet, completely different. He is the antithesis to Julia Ward Howe. Here is Whitman, you know, striding around, very brash. When Whitman wrote Leaves of Grass and it was rejected, he just went into a friend's print shop. He printed it himself. He had it bound himself. The first review said, this is sexually indecent, Leaves of Grass, just outrageous. So he reviewed it himself. In various newspapers, he wrote a number of rave reviews of Leaves of Grass anonymously. Then he printed the book again, and he bound his reviews into the book. And he sent it out again with a picture of himself in the beginning. This famous picture, he's wearing a black hat, he has a white shirt, it's open, he has one hand on his hip, you know, a lot of chest hair, so on. He sent it around, and he sent a copy to Emerson, who was the great, you know, ruler and an authority of American literature, and Emerson wrote him a very nice thank you note, and Whitman published the thank you note in the newspaper. Okay, so when Whitman says, I celebrate myself, okay. Meanwhile, Julia Ward Howe, she went to Boston with some friends in her early 20s, and they went to visit the Perkins Institute for the Blind, which is where Helen Keller was trained later in the century. This was the very beginning of its fame. And the superintendent of the Perkins Institute of the Blind was a young doctor, he was 20 years older than her, but he was young, who was an extremely glamorous, handsome, dashing figure in American culture, and he was sort of the Brad Pitt of the 1840s, and his name was Samuel Gridley Howe. He had volunteered to fight in the Greek Revolution alongside Byron. And the Greeks had rewarded him with they had given him the title Chevalier of Saint Savior. And everybody called him Chev. He was known as Chev. So she was out sort of as a tourist visiting the Perkins Institute of the Blind. And if you ever have a dull day, you said, thank God you're not in the 1840s. And he came riding up. Chev came riding up on a black horse, just like Rochester in Jane Eyre, you know. So she was swept away. He proposed. They got married. And they went to Europe, as they did in those days. They went to Europe for their honeymoon for a year. Now, for him, this was a sabbatical and a working trip. And so he basically dragged her around Europe. She had a terrible time. She was pregnant almost immediately, had the first child while they were in Europe. Nobody would speak to her. Everybody wanted to speak to him, but they were there. They came back. She had the baby, and he moved her in with the baby to the Perkins Institute, which was about 2 miles outside of Boston, not a manageable distance in those days. And she became incredibly depressed. She had three more children quite rapidly. And she completely lost faith in her capacities to write poetry. She had two sisters to whom she wrote constantly. So we know all this because the letters to the sisters have survived and are in the library at Harvard. And she said, I've come to believe I will never be a great poet. I have no talent. I am doomed. I'm trapped here. I am a prisoner in this marriage. So for her own satisfaction, she started to write a novel. This is in the 1840s, about a hermaphrodite, a being born with the sexual organs of both sexes, who the parents decide, because it's better for the child, to raise as a boy named Larry, Larry the hermaphrodite. And this is an amazingly graphic book. Now, she had read quite a lot of French and European literature in which the hermaphrodite, as in Greek sculpture, was a kind of motif, and always a motif of the kind of freakish creature trapped in the wrong body who has more capacities than can be expressed through this single identity, this single gender role, and so on. She wrote this novel. It's quite astonishing. It's very melodramatic. Never showed it to anyone, of course, never attempted to have it published. That is at Harvard, too, and has been reprinted by the University of Nebraska Press. So if you're really curious, you can read The Hermaphrodite. Anyway, put that aside. It was unfinished. And then she thought, well, I'm going to write a book of poems about my life, about my unhappy marriage, about the frustrations of being a woman who wants to be a poet but is the mother of four children, trapped without friends, without an audience, without support, without all of these things. And she called the book of poems Passion Flowers. And she brought it out anonymously the year before Whitman published Leaves of Grass. She did not tell Chev that she was writing the book. And I have this image of them sitting in the library, and Chev is writing away and doing research. He said, what are you doing, darling? You know, oh, nothing, nothing, nothing. You know. So this book came out in the winter of 1853, or December 1853. It was an overnight sensation, Passion Flowers. People just could not believe this book. She was the Sylvia Plath of her day. These books, these poems are so powerful. They're so intimate. They're so extraordinary for somebody writing in, you know, in 1854 in the United States. And the reviews were just rapturous. And people said, well, we know, even though it's anonymous, it has to be by a woman. Who can it be? Who could be writing these poems? And very quickly they figured out, because literary circles were pretty small. Chev, meanwhile, is, you know, doing his thing. And finally, somebody must have said to him, oh, Chev, you know, I see your wife has written a book of poems. And he was furious. So the first thing was he did not speak to her for 3 months. And you imagine them in this institution passing each other, sitting at meals. He would not speak to her. And at the end of the 3 months, meanwhile, the book went through three editions. And even Hawthorne said, this is the best poetry that anyone has written in this country. Went through three editions, and then he said to her, he came to her with a proposition. He said, if you ever publish anything like this again, anything this personal, anything this passionate, anything this intimate, I will divorce you. I will take custody of the older children. I will find a young woman who adores me and will do whatever I want, and I will marry her. That's actually what he said. He didn't know yet who it was going to be, but he knew that he would find one. And she writes to her sisters. She said that she was tormented and so on. And, of course, he could have done these things. I mean, he could have divorced her. He could have taken custody of the children. And she said, I made the sacrifice. And by June of that year, she was pregnant with her fifth child. Never wrote anything like this again. And people, when they read the Battle Hymn of the Republic, critics who look at it sometimes say, isn't it interesting that this poem by a woman is so angry? It is so belligerent, you know? Well, if you know anything about Julia Ward, you understand where some of that anger came from. And when I was writing the book, I mean, one of the questions that I had to ask as a literary historian is, as a literary historian, can you include a failed genius? And I decided, absolutely, you have to. I mean, the book exists, but you have to, because it is the answer to that question. And it's true that many male writers have had hard lives and have been in despair, have been rejected, have been forgotten, but I do not know one case of a male writer who was forbidden by his wife ever to publish his work and gave in. So that is a little bit of the background. I think that things are, hopefully they're better now. I think women are free to write, but I don't think yet we have reached a moment where they are judged and understood and included as fully as they need to be. And those are the reasons why I wanted to write this book. And although it's the first literary history of American women writers, I'm sure, I'm confident it's not going to be the last one. Thank you. Now, I'd be delighted to answer questions if you have them. Yeah.
When did she write the Battle Hymn of the Republic?
She wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic in the early years of the Civil War. Her husband, who was quite an accomplished man and very active in abolitionist circles, was one of Lincoln's chief advisors about setting up the Union Army hospitals. And so he was in Washington consulting with Lincoln about setting them up, and they made an excursion. Of course, at that point, people thought Washington might be invaded by the Confederate Army and so on. They made an excursion outside Washington to one of the battlefields. And there was a strong feeling during the Civil War that there should be anthems on each side. The Confederacy never really got one. They tried, but they never really came up with one. But the song that the Union soldiers always sang was John Brown's Body. And so Julia Ward Howe says that that night they were back in the hotel in Washington, and she had, of course, a baby, nursing baby with her, as she always did. And she was awake at night with the baby, and the words began to come to her, and so she sat up all night and wrote the poem. And it was first published by the Atlantic Monthly. She did several different versions of it. It's really a, it was really a poem. I mean, it's not just an outpouring, but it was something that she definitely crafted. And that was how it happened, and it immediately took off, and is now, you know, sung and played at so many events, not just in the United States, but all over the world.
Was Phyllis Wheatley included in your writing? I just had a chance to peruse it a few minutes before we started, but was she included?
Phyllis Wheatley, of course. I mean, how could Phyllis Wheatley be left out? And it's quite amazing. I mean, if you look at the if you do go through chronologically, how many patterns are revealed after a kind of flurry of writing in the 17th century from the Puritan settlers. Then there was a pretty long silence until the Revolution. And then there begin and then you begin to see some literary activity around the time of the Revolution. But the women who emerged during that period were really first, I mean, the first woman dramatist, the first feminist essayist, the first African-American woman poet, all during that period. And Phyllis Wheatley's particularly tragic story, an early tragic story, because she was brought to the United States as a slave. They thought she was 7 by looking at her teeth. They didn't really even know how old she was. And she was taken in by a family that immediately recognized her intelligence and tutored her and educated her. And she started writing this extraordinarily proficient poetry and became quite a celebrity. They went to England. She was, you know, hailed everywhere, but sadly died very young. Yes, she was taken in by a family that nurtured her gift. Absolutely. Not only the parents, but the 2 teenage children taught her. But then it was very, very sad. I mean, the parents in the family died. She married. She had a number of children. The husband deserted her. She tried to get more work published. Very, very tragic ending. And the story, the aftermath of this story in history is very sad too, because it's a little bit like Uncle Tom's Cabin, but on the other side, there was a whole period during which African-American critics were very patronizing and contemptuous of Phyllis Wheatley because they said that she was too white, that she had assimilated too much of a sort of classical education, and she wasn't angry enough, she wasn't writing in a modern way. And so for a long time she was disregarded, even by black critics and historians. But I think that she has been firmly rediscovered now. And some of her work is still lost. Every now and then, somebody finds a poem, a manuscript poem by Phyllis Wheatley that comes up at auction. And if you find one, you are in good shape. They go for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, very rare. So she is really someone who's now cherished and highly regarded. Yes. In the middle, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that the audience for some of the female writers died, and then their popularity, and your example was Pearl Buck. But I remember way back when I was in college and doing English courses, that, I mean, you have to blame some of the problem on the syllabus that was chosen by the professors in English, because I don't remember any female writers on that.
You know,
they were all male. You know?
I know. Well, I mean, I went to college at Bryn Mawr. And Bryn Mawr was very meticulous about educating students. We had these reading lists, and I remember there's something like 368 male writers on that list. And we didn't read any women writers except Jane Austen. We didn't even read women writers who had gone to Bryn Mawr. Marianne Moore, you know, H.D. So most extraordinary suppression, really, of women's writing. And sometimes it can be, sometimes it's veiled with a kind of objectivity. Sometimes people say, oh, well, they must not have been good enough. They would have survived if they were good enough. Some sort of belief that time in some vague, transparent way makes these decisions. But other times there's really quite a vicious trashing of these women writers by subsequent generations. And it's only been very recently that American male writers have begun to acknowledge they're being influenced by women. I remember it vividly, Robert Stone, who made his name writing tough guy novels about Vietnam, wonderful writer. And he's the first male American writer I know who said he was very much influenced by Kate Chopin in the 1890s, and he wrote a whole novel that is his take on the awakening. And for a lot of male writers, it's as if there's something shameful about admitting that they were influenced by a woman writer, even that they read anything by a woman writer. I think we should be so beyond that. It's appalling to me that this is still the case. Yeah. Wait for the mic.
What about somebody like Edith Wharton and Willa Cather?
Yes.
Who remain and who must have had some you know, success during their lifetime.
Well, they did. Their careers had real ups and downs. And although they were highly esteemed during their lives and given all kinds of awards, they went through several decades of decline, where they were rejected, they were ridiculed, they disappeared, they weren't being taught, they weren't in print, and they came back. I have a separate chapter in my book for Wharton and Cather, and one of the things that I say in that chapter is that they were women and Americans who certainly did not want to be identified as women writers, and in Wharton's case, didn't want to be identified as an American writer. Wharton spent most of her adult life abroad, and she was quite anti-American in her writing and, you know, very vicious about American culture and, you know, how beneath her it was. After you've seen Paris, you know, how can you go back to Kansas? But what I say about that is that I think that if you think of it historically, kind of process of evolution, I think it was very important that there was a time when there were women writers of great gifts who said, we don't want to be limited to women's writing such as it was in their day. We claim everything. We have the right to take on any subject. I think that was really important. And they were among the first to do that. They weren't the only ones. And there were many women who did it as well. One of the things that I think is very striking about Uncle Tom's Cabin is that the first chapter of Uncle Tom's Cabin is a conversation between two men. And in Harriet Beecher Stowe's day, it was more or less an axiom that women writers were not supposed to have scenes that showed men talking to each other when no women were there. The idea was, how would a woman possibly be able to imagine what men talked about when they weren't around? You know, and a lot of women writers respected that. But Stowe just sort of blithely, the first chapter, you know, she's not going to be held back by anything like that. She's going to take on the most forbidden subjects from male conversation to slavery, and did this. So I think that was always part of the ambition of women writers, was to take that we can write about anything. We are not going to be limited. But even the greatest certainly went through periods of incredible decline. And even Stowe, one of these American literary histories, a very important one, came out in 1941, and another one in 1948. They very often come out around wars. People are feeling very nationalistic. And completely ridiculed Stowe, that Uncle Tom's Cabin was just a silly book and it wasn't worth anyone's serious attention. And by 1948, Uncle Tom's Cabin was out of print in the United States. So these, you know, they can have really serious impact on people's reading habits. If the book is out of print, it is in a sense dead. It's not going to be available. It's not going to circulate. But luckily, literary reputation works in cycles and they can be brought back. I'm sorry, I can't hear.
Alice Walker did that for Zora Neale Hurston. Her book was sort of out of print, and she resurrected that book.
Yes, yeah. Alice Walker almost single-handedly set out to recover Zora Neale Hurston, wrote about her, went down and restored her grave, actually, gave her a gravestone. It's very moving often when you read these stories about a woman writer of one generation going back and rescuing someone who had gone before. And I think this is absolutely true. And but that shouldn't be the only way it has to be done. When I started teaching at Princeton, I know that it would have been very unusual for my male colleagues to have said that they had read Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Are Watching God. But they changed pretty fast, you know, and when people started writing about it and saying this is an important novel, an important writer, then they turned their attention to it. So it can work. Yes, back there.
Could you, I'm curious about Harper Lee.
Yes.
And To Kill a Mockingbird.
Fascinating, Harper Lee.
And I have been looking into some information about her after she finished writing the book.
Yeah.
But I can't find any other writings that she's done.
None.
And do you know why?
That's why, yeah. She never wrote another novel. Now, right after the huge success of To Kill a Mockingbird, there were a number of interviews that she gave in which she said she was working on a second novel. No one has ever seen a word of it. And too long has gone by. I mean, it's pretty clear that she is not going to write anything again. I have quite a long section about Harper Lee in the book. I think To Kill a Mockingbird is another one of those novels. It's a great bestseller, wonderful book. Just, you know, can stand any kind of literary analysis. Really interesting book. But it's sort of been treated, it was a popular book, it's a children's book, you teach it in junior high, something like that. I mean, there's a way of killing a literary work without saying so outright. And she may have sensed that. It's a very autobiographical book, as you know, about her own father. And when I looked at it and wrote about it for the purposes of this book, I was aware how much of that book is really very feminist and is really about the experiences of Scout, the younger sister who is nine in the book and then writing it from a later point, where the older brother is going to inherit manhood. He's going to inherit the role of Atticus. But the sister, Scout, really has nothing to look to. What is going to happen to her when she grows up? The only women around her are kind of silly, fussy Southern women, except for the black women in the family, who she admires tremendously. But it's really a book about, it's also a book about growing up female at a particular time and place in American culture. You know, Harper Lee is still alive, can't give up. But I think it's very unlikely, and I think her silence definitely has something to do with her sex.
Hi, Hi, I'm curious if you could say more about the task of writing a literary history at this time. I got my doctorate, American Lit, in the 90s and
so you
2000.
Know.
And so I'm the beneficiary, I think, of the recovery projects.
Yes.
That what my experience, you know, was we were constantly having women writers on the syllabus and being discovered and being rewarded for that. Yet people in my generation of doctor work aren't doing these projects either.
No.
I think that's the, you know, the issue is there's a weariness to kind of take on this idea of writing a history or a linear or a cohesive narrative of influence. So say more about how you write your narrative about contemporary writing. What do you choose? How do you build a narrative? Who are you talking to or against?
Well, I don't think of myself as talking against. When I set out to write the book, I had several advantages. I was retired. I didn't have to teach. I was outside of the academic community, but having been part of it, I think I had a kind of freedom. And a lot of my colleagues were very skeptical about my taking on this kind of task, as you say. And I think there's also, you know, there are cycles in academic interests and research too. And this is not an era in which people want to take on great big projects like this. I mean, the job market is so tricky. People have to get tenure. There are all kinds of pressures. It's a very difficult career. So there's not too many people willing to take it on. But I did not have a list of women writers. I didn't begin by making out a list of women writers. I began with reading. I just immersed myself as much as I could, and I read decade by decade. And by the time I got up to the 80s, let's say, I had worked out through going through the other decades the things that in the past, the categories that were important, what had stood out as important. And that guided me. I know perfectly well, and as I've said, I mean, it's part of my intention, that what I'm doing is subjective. I taught literature for 40 years, so I think my opinion, you know, has some quality, but I'm not infallible. I know that people want to argue about this, but I also felt that argument is what keeps literature alive, not some kind of, you know, lip service. Oh, very worthy. Harriet Beecher Stowe, put her in the very back of the library, you know, ho-hum, so boring. Or, on the other hand, saying, perfect, wonderful writer, can do no wrong, every word is a pearl. We must not criticize her, which was another tendency in feminist criticism, too, that we must not criticize women writers because we might, it was too precarious. Their status was too precarious. And my feeling was women writers can take it. They are good enough. You can apply the most stringent techniques of literary analysis to this work, and it will stand up. So I sort of went through, I mean, and I thought, my first question, what is really wonderful to read? What do I really enjoy reading? What seems to survive for me? And there were so many surprising answers for me in asking that question. And then I tried to trust it in two directions. One, who I would include, even a writer who maybe academically or commercially was considered unimportant, but I said this is wonderful. And I think of somebody like Jean Stafford, American novelist in the 1940s, who was one of I corresponded at one point with Jean Stafford towards the end of her life. She was the most anti-feminist, horrible, bitter, impossible woman, but a terrific writer, you know. And she was very nasty to me personally, even, but she was just a wonderful writer, and she needs to be reread. So that was one thing. It was really just on the basis of the work and what I thought of that work and what I could say about it and put out there. And, you know, if other people don't agree, we can, you know, argue about it. They can take another position. And then the other side of that was there were some people I just didn't want to talk about at all. Although I know that, you know, there's a big hoo-ha about them and you're supposed to take them very seriously, I just thought, oh, this is so uninteresting to me, and I can say a little bit about that. The one that's getting the most attention is Gertrude Stein. Now, Gertrude Stein is in the book. Gertrude Stein played a role, significant role, in the history of American women's writing, and I couldn't leave her out, but I just think she's so awful. And, you know, so... And I'm going to be doing an anthology in a year that's going to go with this book. And I try to think, is there anything by Gertrude Stein that I would want to recommend to my daughter to read, you know, or a friend? And there isn't. I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, if that's your career specialty, okay. But the ordinary person, it is just so over praised and so dull and so uninteresting. So I say that about Gertrude Stein. But there are also some women writers who are not as well known as Gertrude Stein who have their partisans. And if I didn't agree in this book, I felt free to say so and why. You probably wouldn't have heard of a 19th century woman novelist named Elizabeth Stoddard. But there are some academics who are very enthusiastic about the work of Elizabeth Stoddard, who was a novelist and a poet, and they have got her books reissued and written very enthusiastic introductions to them. And you know, I talk about her. I just think she doesn't measure up. I just don't think the books are that good. They have a lot of problems, I think. So I sort of talk about that too. I can't say, you know, there's no system to it. It's just you kind of keep working through. But I will say this is the hardest book, the hardest project I've ever undertaken. And it really was hard. I mean, thinking about this and thinking about how these women related to each other and how they related to the time in which they were writing, those were my overriding questions. And I certainly didn't have the answers to that when I started. And it's still incomplete, so I do hope that other people will take up the project and, you know, write more and discover more women and argue with me and argue with each other. Yes, back there. Man in that row on the left. Yeah. Okay, this one and then one more after.
You partially answered my question by referring to a companion volume, the mm-hmm. anthology that you're planning. But I was wondering, with the wealth of material that you've developed and the great insights that you have, if you would reconsider and publish yet another volume on this subject.
Ah, listen, get thee behind me, Satan. I would love to. There's so much. I mean, it was very frustrating. I knew that I wanted it to be one volume, and I kept saying that to myself because I could have written 10 times more. There's so much more to say about the women that I include, and there were women that I wasn't able to deal with. Ayn Rand isn't in the book. For a lot of complicated reasons, it isn't even a matter of literary judgment, but I just couldn't find a way to see where she fit with the other women, and there were other women who I thought were more important, you know, to talk about. But that's one example. There's so much more. But I think, you know, I'll have the anthology. I'll get a chance to say a little bit more. But I think that it, like my first book, what's really kept me going about this and is so bracing about it and exhilarating about it is the feeling that it's going to be useful and that other people can pick it up and go on. And that was how I felt about my first book. It's not something that academic writers always feel. So it's a real blessing to have that sense that I don't have to say everything. I don't even have to attempt to say everything. Other people have a lot more to say. But thank you. And one more in the middle. Yeah. Yeah, yes.
And even these people were rediscovering, like Julia Ward Howe, I wonder how you negotiated that. I mean, given that we women generally have access throughout these historical periods you're writing from, how do you bring in the phenomenon?
Well, I don't. In the book, I don't really divide them between elite and non-elite. It's one of the great advantages of chronology. Okay. I mean, I thought that would be a very helpful way to look at them, because I can look at who was writing during the 1930s, who was writing, for example, another very powerful decade, the 1950s. Who was writing during the 1950s? Well, Grace Metalius. But Grace Metalius is really very closely connected to Shirley Jackson, who I think is, you know, one of the great American writers of this century. So I think there's a lot of continuity, and the kinds of themes that women writers focus on during a particular time are extremely revealing, one and the other, as they come up. So I don't separate it, you know, in the sense that this is popular and this is highfalutin or elite or whatever. It's just in this year, these books came out. This is how people reacted to them. This is how people learned. I mentioned Forever Amber, which was a, you know, sort of secret reading of my childhood. How many of you have read Forever Amber? Oh, some Forever Amber fans. Okay. Well, Forever Amber is a real blockbuster, and I really recommend it. It's quite remarkable book. And it is about a young woman during the English Civil War who becomes the mistress of King Charles, but is also having an affair with a sort of English aristocrat who is also a privateer, and very much of a... it's very much of a Gone with the Wind plot. He's sort of a Rhett Butler character, but more complicated even. And it's full of detail about England in the 17th century and the plague, which I remembered vividly and so on. Well, she was an American. She was from Minnesota. She had never been to England when she wrote this book. She did all the research in the library, where her husband was studying at the University of California at Berkeley. And all of her manuscripts are now in Austin, Texas, in the Humanities Center. That was just so fascinating for me. Kathleen Windsor was her name. She was married many times. She married Artie Shaw. She was very beautiful. I mean, she had all of the trappings of a sort of, glamorous bestseller writer, but she was a scholar, she was a revolutionary, she was an incredible innovator, and it seems to me very one of the reasons that book was so popular is it spoke to women of the 1940s, and I've talked about it in England too, and I've met a lot of women in England who were reading it after the war and were very exhilarated by it because she's a survivor, and that was what attracted them. So I think the themes are human complex themes, and they tell us a great deal about the times, and the greatest are readable forever. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.